This is the recording of the fourth and the last chapter of Part 2 Eliot's Theories. Name of the chapter, The Function of Criticism. Being a classicist, Eliot advocates order in life, order in society, order in art, and order even in criticism. He finds contemporary English criticism chaotic, vague, and unsystematic because the expressionistic school of criticism was in vogue. No objective or scientific method was formulated to judge a work of art. Slinging mud at one another, the critics enjoyed the advantage of enthusiasm, and they were occupied in their personal prejudices and eccentricities with fixed ideas and a cultivated taste. Eliot observes the criticism is no better than a Sunday park of contending and contentious orators who have not even arrived at the articulation of their differences. He considers such critics impostors who listen to inner voice or vagary. Thus, Eliot repeatedly decries expressionism, subjectivism, inspiration, interpretation, and individuality. According to Eliot, the significance of an artist is ascertained when he surrenders himself to a sense of tradition and has relation with the other artists. A true artist forms an unconscious community. The more he tries to efface his personality, the more he will be able to collaborate, to exchange, to contribute. Just as a politician has an allegiance to a government and a believer to a church, similarly, a critic is of no value if he does not surrender himself to outside authority, which is more important than his personal judgment. If he believes in the individual liberty or the romantic school of criticism, which is supposed to be rooted in English people, Eliot frowns upon such critics. He says that the question is not what comes naturally or easily, but the question is what is right. Eliot propounds an empirical method of criticism and adheres to discipline, tradition, order, formalism, and impersonality in art as well as in criticism. His The Function of Criticism, issuing forth from tradition and individual talent, deals with nature, function, aims, and methods of criticism. Criticism is a cooperative labor, and a true critic should endeavor to control his whims and establish a healthy relationship with his fellow critics in the common pursuit of true judgment. A critic's aim must be to know what kinds of criticism are useful and functional. He must adopt some definite positions to reject something and select something else. Criticism is not an autotelic activity, It is the commentation and exposition of works of art by means of written words. A good critic is always a good artist. The criticism employed by a trained and skillful writer on his own work is the most vital and highest kind of criticism. In the process of creation of his writings, his critical faculty also remains conscious and he works a hard critical labor, the labor of sifting, combining, constructing, expunging, correcting, testing. That is why some creative writers are greater than others only because their critical faculty is superior. This critical labor comes in the heat of creation, which is rare and apparent in the work. It seems that no critical labor has been done, but the expressionistic critics disapprove the critical toil, thinking that a great artist is always an unconscious artist and listen to inner voice. Eliot finds justification that the only critics worth reading are the critics who practice the art they write and fuse criticism with creation. Eliot's formula tells that the important qualification of a good critic is that he must have a very highly developed sense of fact. It is not an ordinary thing, nor does it come very easily. It is achieved with great labor and in a slow process. The complete development of the sense of fact means the highest stage of human development. Eliot's fact does not mean the sociological or historical or biographical facts, but the technical aspects of art, its genesis, conditions, structure, setting, and theme. In Eliot's view, the function of criticism is to throw light on the problem and difficulty of works of art and to correct the taste of the reader. This can be obtained by applying two important tools, compare and analysis. It is the duty of a critic to point out what is relevant and what is irrelevant to the study of the reader. He should present the fact and leave it to the reader to form his own judgment. A critic must not say what is good art and what is bad. The scholarly interpretation cannot fulfill this purpose because it supplies merely opinions which corrupt the taste instead of educating it. Nor does it guarantee the competence of an artist. The real corruptors are Goethe, G-O-E-T-H-E, and Coleridge, C-O-L-E-R-I-D-G-E, who supply opinion of fancy. On the other hand, fact does not corrupt because it is not interpretative but analytical, and the critic knows what to compare and what to annihilate. However, Eliot is against the lemon squeezer school of critics who try to squeeze every drop of meaning out of words and lines. This chapter is now over. Thank you.